Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
Hey, it's Cindy Howes and Lizzie Ngo from the podcast Basic Folk, honest conversations with folk musicians.
Basic Folk is truly changing the game with our well-researched deep dives that aim to empower the listener while fostering the folk community.
I basically am writing worship music for youth group rejects.
Maternal regrets and maternal guilt are universal.
I try to make things that are beautiful and that are made with like a purity of intention.
You can listen to Basic Folk on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or at basicfolk.com.
Thompson Guitars makes handcrafted instruments in Oregon. Their guitars are built with select tone woods, including Brazilian rosewood. Go to pktguitars.com for more information about their different models and appointments available from their custom shop.
Hey, I'm Tom Power, and this is Toy Heart, a podcast about bluegrass. Well, welcome to another episode of Toy Heart for this second season. I hope you've been digging it so far. Thanks for all the kind words on the second season so far. If you missed any of our conversations so far with like Sam Bush or Tim O'Brien or Laurie Lewis or Larry Sparks or even the first season like Ricky Skaggs and Bela Fleck, you can find them wherever you got this podcast. If you like the show, subscribe. That's a big one. But I'm learning that reviews, like especially on like Apple Podcasts, I don't know if Spotify does reviews, but like reviews, like leaving a little note and stars on Apple Podcasts really helps us be able to make more episodes. So if you get a couple of minutes, I know I don't really ever do that, but if you get a couple of minutes, it would actually really help us out a lot. So this season on Toy Heart is interesting for a couple of reasons. One is like, we got some really big stars in bluegrass. I mean, you heard Sam Bush on the first episode. You're going to hear Allison Krauss before the season is out. I'm really excited about that. You never get to hear from Allison. But also, you've been hearing from people who are really respected in bluegrass and old-time music who maybe haven't got their due in the same way. So a few things to say here before we get started. Jody Stecker plays bluegrass, for sure, but also a lot more. He's played Bahamian music, North Indian music, a lot of old-time music, where he's one of the most respected players in that world. His albums have gone on to inspire legions of folk musicians. And in case you were wondering, like, yeah, but like, bluegrass, Tom, it's a podcast about bluegrass. Just listen to this.
The weight of the years is a burden. It's got me so weary and sore. I won't carry it round. I'm putting it down. I won't carry it round anymore.
So that's Jody Stecker from this year, joined by the Boston bluegrass band Mile 12 with an amazing original composition. I was sort of doubtful about it. I was like, I don't know if I need to hear a new bluegrass song. And it broke my heart. The Weight of the Years, that song is called. So let me talk you a little bit through how Jody Stecker ended up on this season of Toy Heart. I was talking about this a little bit when we had Larry Sparks on, but I feel like when you get into this music and you want to get deeper and deeper and deeper into the true soulful sound of the music, in Irish music, they call it the pure drop, the true life blues. Eventually, you find your way to artists more off the beaten path. You know, the music might sound a little rougher, but there's deep soul and power to their sound. I mean, I really feel like when you get into bluegrass, you start with Bill Monroe. And if you're looking for the real thing, you end with Bill Monroe, too. But when I was digging through, you know, records and Spotify and playlists and CDs and articles, somewhere along the way, I found this record called Going Up on the Mountain by Jody Stecker. And when I put it on, I had never heard anything like it before. It was about as close as I've ever felt to the way I felt when I first heard the Stanley Brothers or Bill Monroe. No emphasis on flash, just heart and soul. you know, a big influence of like old time fiddling and old time rhythms, the same way that was in early Bill Monroe and the Stanley Brothers. And the more I looked into Jody, the more I found one of the deepest thinkers in modern folk music. So we wanted to get him on to talk about his story, which he very rarely tells, but also his perspective on music. Why sometimes old recordings sound bad to younger ears. Like, I remember when I first heard Bill Monroe play Get Up John, I was like, this sounds bad. And I learned it doesn't at all, actually. He'll talk about the best way to practice, how having a meditation practice can help you become a better bluegrass musician. And listen, this conversation takes all kinds of twists and turns and side roads. It's not a linear conversation, but I came away thinking so differently about the music that I love and the music that presumably, if you're listening to this, you love too. Jody Stecker is a virtuoso banjo player, guitarist, mandolinist, sarod player, an excellent tune composer, an incredible singer, a member of Peter Rowan's bluegrass band, one of the first ever northern bluegrass bands he was in with a young David Grisman. He'll tell that story. One of the most important Bay Area bluegrass bands he was in with Jerry Garcia. He'll tell that story too. His albums with Kate Brislin, Jody Stecker and Kate Brislin, are some of the best harmony, bluegrass, old-time country albums ever. And like I said, it's rare to have a conversation like this one. Rare to get a chance to talk to Jody at all. So right now, if you're being introduced to him, I really hope you get something out of this. If you're not already subscribed to our podcast, please do so. All right, hold on to your hats. Here's my conversation with Jody Stecker. So you're from Brooklyn, is that right?
I was born in Brooklyn, yeah. Grew up there.
Grew up there, what your parents, were they, what did they do in there?
Well, they were born there too. Their parents were immigrants from Eastern Europe, you know, all four parents. My dad was a physics professor, and he specialized in waves, sound, and you know, and light. And so we had some good talks, and I just started learning to play music. You know, by the time I was 12, I understood how a vibrating string worked and why the string on the mandolin and could be the same gauge but a different length as one on a banjo, and the string didn't know what instrument it was on. And this really shaped my way of thinking. When, you know, it was easy to become a multi-instrumentalist when I looked at it in that way, although I wouldn't have expressed it so coherently then. I go, you know, it's kind of the same, but only different, you know? Something like that. And he was very interested in teaching. He started out being interested in physics. He taught at the university. And as he got older, he got more interested in how people learn rather than the subject matter. And when he passed away, I went through his papers and I found some writings of his. And one of the, you know, there was one page that had one sentence. It was, teach the student, not the subject. In other words, you have to speak to the person and differently. And I later on in my life, when I had some great teachers, one in particular, I got to watch how he taught, and everybody was different and he used different language. And this affected me as a teacher. My mother.
What was her name?
Miriam Brody Stecker. Milton was my dad's name. Mm-hmm. Miriam was her name. She played a little bit of guitar. She worked with really young children, like preschool children, and teachers of very young children, with movement and sound as opposed to dance and music, nothing that structured. And she had a guitar, which I learned on. It was a small guitar. In fact, you might be able to see it behind me. Is it? You see a guitar?
Is that the one right there? That's the same guitar?
That's the guitar I learned on, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's made by Raphael Ciani.
Yeah.
Who was the maternal uncle of Johnny D'Angelico, the jazz guitar maker. It's a little guitar, and it was great for 11-year-old hands. 11. That's 11, yeah.
What were you playing on that guitar back then?
Like this.
Like what kind of music were you? Let's hear it.
Just playing mostly on the three or four highest strings. Whoops. Whoa. Whoa. stuff like that.
It still sounds great, by the way.
It's fantastic. Yeah. I keep it tuned low. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like this guitar.
Were you playing country music? Were you playing? I mean,
undifferentiated folk music, but it included country music. Yeah. My dad played auto harp and harmonica, both pretty well, pretty nice.
Where did that interest in the music come from? You said their parents came over from Eastern Europe. You guys were in Brooklyn. Where did their interest in this music come from? In wanting to play auto harp and guitar?
Well, my dad, like I said, was interested in strings, and auto harp had a lot of strings.
Yeah.
Monica, no. I was born in 1946. So was Kate, my wife Kate. We've both remarked on this, that our families would sing, get together, in several generations. And this was common back then.
Yeah.
Television, we didn't have a television. We had radio. I had television when I was 8, a little black and white TV, but people had, weren't being entertained all the time. And when they wanted to, they did it themselves and made music. My mother's sister, her younger sister, used to sing for fun with a group of friends that eventually became the Weavers.
Wow.
Which side are you on? 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 Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell, of how a good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Like Ronnie Gilbert, yeah. Was her good buddy.
Would they have also been involved in the political side of the Weavers as well?
Not so much.
Okay.
My parents were Democrats, mm-hmm. but certainly not Republicans, mm-hmm. but they weren't socialist or communist or any of that.
There was the singing part of that, the folk singing, the group singing, the community singing part of that. I understand.
Yeah. So there was that, my grandparents on my mother's side, they knew some Russian songs too, it would be that, and I'd hear some of that. But you asked about country music. I listened to that on the radio all the time. I could discover it. I could get WWVA and I can get WCKY.
So that was WCKY is Cincinnati. WWVA is out of Wheeling. That would have been the same station that we would get in Newfoundland. And I guess around those times, that would have been like... Yeah.
They were really popular in Canada.
So that would have been, in bluegrass wise, I guess that would have been Osborne Brothers years?
It would be the Osborne Brothers and Jimmy Martin and the Sunny Mountain Boys.
You should get a medal, dear, for every broken heart, for every life you've ruined, 'cause you think you're so smart. I never even had a chance, and now my life is long. Once more you've had your fun, and you don't care how much it costs. Oh, chalk up another one, another broken heart.
And in both cases, it was a trio. No bass player that I ever heard, no fiddle player, and they took chances. And it wasn't neat. Like on the records, the singing was phenomenal. These were young people. They were just Sonny Osborne was what, 9 years older than me or something like that? I mean, not a lot. I was playing music with people that age also. But Sonny would be very creative. You just have no idea what he was going to do. He inspired me that way, to take chances on stage and just go for it. Baby Crow was more careful in what he did, but how he did it was, no holds barred. I mean, it was explosive. And it really, I know I've said to other interviewers this thing. I don't think I've ever said anything I've told you so far, but I remember this, that it sounded like he was going to kick him from inside. He was going to bust the radio speaker, and it sounded like he was kicking at it. It was just so strong. He really had a strong right hand. And I was into all this as, you know, at age 12. And like, what's he doing? How is he doing that? I want to do that.
Is there any local bluegrass happening? Like, was it the King County Outpatients? Are they?
Yeah, Kings County is Brooklyn.
Okay.
It's adjacent to the county called Queens, which you've probably heard of as a borough of New York.
That's right.
Kings is Brooklyn, Kings County. Kings County is a mental hospital. And my cousin, Eric J. Feldman, was the mandolin player in the Kings County Outpatients. And I would sometimes sub for him when he couldn't do a gig, you know, at age 13 or 14. These guys were 3-4 years older than me. That was Brooklyn's first bluegrass band. And then in Manhattan, you know, there was the Green Briar Boys.
If I win or lose, oh, I don't get the blues. Oh, a rambling joker, that's me.
I later became a Green Briar Boy. When Ralph Rinsler left the band, he was the mandolin player.
So was it Ralph, then you, then Frank Wakefield?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I just got out of high school, and you know, Ralph dropped out to be a manager of Doc Watson and Bill Monroe, and they needed me. They had a big tour, and they needed somebody, and I could sing tenor. I mean, the other David Grisman was there too. He was a real good mandolin player, but not really a singer at that time. So, you know, being the vocalist, they called me.
Is there something that clicks for you when you, I've asked this to a lot of people I've had on the show, and I get a very varied response. When you started playing with your cousin's band and subbing in, was there something that clicked? Was there something inside of you that would have said, okay, this feels right. This is it. I mean, I'm going to chase whatever this feeling is.
Not so much when I did with them. That was just, I mean, they were just so spectacularly silly. And none of them quite as intent on the music as I was.
Right.
But yeah, playing in bands and for sure, and just playing solo and all that, so much so that I never considered any other life path but to be a musician. And I got a lot of reinforcement from this, from teachers in school, they all knew it and they all told me this. And, you know, I was really quite innocent and unworldly. I didn't really know how to get a job.
I sound like a lot of my relatives, Joe.
Yeah, this is the Irish side. Right? That's power. Right? I did deliver laundry for local dry cleaner a couple of times, but you know, because somebody asked me.
Yeah.
I got gigs from the age of 12, and I never solicited them. I just would get a phone call, and oh, okay, so you know, you need money to eat. Need money for whatever, you know, and so, okay, well, people are willing to pay me to have a good time doing what I enjoy most, playing music. I'll do that. So, yeah, it felt right. But no, there was not a moment where it clicked in, man, this is what I want to do. And really, you know, I never wanted to be the front man, to be, you know, the leader of a band, to be be on the stage, to be seen, to be validated by an audience. I was interested in making the music. And so, you know, I left the road, oh gosh, about 9 years ago or something. I stopped touring. I do occasional local things or something else, sit in with somebody, but I haven't missed it because that's not my main interest. But I got, just like my dad got real interested in teaching and how people learn, I got real interested in what happens on stage and the energy exchange between the musician and the audience. And there's this circuit that happens. It's a circuit. Yeah. It goes back and forth. And I got good at it. I didn't start out good at it. I just, you know, let somebody else do the talking, pick the songs. And I sang a harmony and took a mandolin break, and, you know, but gradually I learned the stagecraft, but that it took a while because that wasn't my primary interest.
can you tell me about the New York Ramblers?
Sure.
So that was another early New York bluegrass band.
Yeah, so there were, of my generation, there were two mandolin players who were competent or better. It was David Grisman and me. There was a few people who were a little older who were good. And from David's point of view, David and Jody could never be in the same band because, of course, I'd want to play mandolin. Of course, secretly, he wanted to play banjo. This came out later. But no, I just wanted to play. And so we ended up, you know, me playing guitar and singing and him playing mandolin. It didn't make any difference to me. I played bass in other bands from time to time, whatever they needed. I just wanted to play the music. So the New York Ramblers was originally Winnie Winston, really good banjo player.
Pedal steel player too, right?
He later pedal steel. He wrote the first book on how to play pedal steel. But anyway, Winnie, David Grisman, Fred Weiss, Fred and David were from Passaic, New Jersey, and they were, you know, since early teens, were bluegrass buddies. Fred sometimes played fiddle, sometimes played bass. Gene Loewinger, who later played with Bill Monroe, played fiddle. And Eric Thompson, who is a Californian, was the first guitar player. When they got together, I think I was off with the Greenbrier Boys, maybe summer 63, 60, I don't know. Eric went back to California. I took over on guitar. Sometimes I wasn't playing in the band and Jim Field was playing. Sometimes both of us were in the band. I played lead guitar and he played rhythm. James Field, you know.
Yeah. But where were these gigs? Like, where were you doing these gigs? What were the gigs you were doing?
The main one was Gertie's Folk City.
Oh, the legendary Gertie's Folk City. Yeah.
You know, a job for a week or a week, 2 weeks even. Well, certainly a week at a time. But other places. And we'd also go down to the band contest at Union Grove, North Carolina. I won some ribbons there. The band won a couple of times.
Was there any moment when you went down to Union Grove? Union Grove, that's in North Carolina, right?
Yeah.
Was there, I've heard John Cohen talk about this, that was there any sense that, well, maybe you could tell me the story, that you had been playing this music within the city, within the confines of the city and within the feeling of the city in the north. And then when you go to a place that's more south, we'll say, there is another sort of light bulb, something clicks, or maybe there's some intimidation about being around sort of the heart of the music. Did you experience any of that?
No, there was two people who in a very small way tried to intimidate me. One kid stuck a pin in me, probably someone told him I would explode. Yankees explode if you dig, you know. And I, the second year I went down there, I had pretty long hair and some fellow came up and said, "Hello, sister." Little did he know that every Southern man would have long hair and a beard before he, you know, in a very short time.
Yes. I'm always so curious about that experience about being this Northern band coming down, especially in those early days, being this Northern musicians coming down to this thing, you know?
Other than that, no, we were very much welcomed. People were very friendly. People wanted to, you know, we actually influenced people. They wanted to play a bit like us. They hadn't heard a whole lot of lead guitar, for one thing. And I spent a lot of time listening, wandering around. There were three contests, three venues. In this, it was at a high school. And there were so many people there that they had to run it three simultaneous places. And you went from place to place. There was the gymnasium. There was a big tent. And there was the auditorium. There was a lot of musicians there who were born in the 19th century. And I was just really interested in hearing them play. And one really interesting thing is that, you know, even back then, the people who weren't born to the music, whether they were from the South or the North, felt like, oh, bluegrass music is good. Old-time music is old-fashioned. It's boring. Oh, old-time music is the authentic thing. This is really good. This has soul. Bluegrass is just flash. They all had these opinions of what's really the same thing. They're just different dialects of a similar language. And I found that the older musicians were interested in what I was doing. They were very encouraging. I was interested in what they were doing. I was really fascinated with the local bluegrass bands and what good singers they were. So I would just go, you know, when we weren't practicing, which wasn't much, we weren't on, I'd just go from place to place and listen to what people were doing. Plus there were jams outdoors, you know, and I'd be playing with the local people. Now I got mostly friendliness. I had no fear.
Can you talk to me more about, because I know about this from being a fan of yours, but for people who wouldn't have heard you talk about it before, can you talk to me more, because it feels like that stratification is larger than ever right now between bluegrass music and old-time music.
Right.
But, you know, when you listen to Bill Monroe, when I would listen to Bill Monroe, I mean, I talked to Mike Compton about this the other day, he was playing the fiddle. He was playing old-time fiddle on the mandolin.
You were absolutely right. Yeah. He was a Kentucky fiddler that happened to play the mandolin. And you, if you study what he's playing, he's using fiddle phrasing. He can't play between the frets, but he's implying it. A few little microtonal stuff.
The early Stanley Brothers recordings. Those, the distance between old time music and bluegrass music was, in some ways, non-existent. And I've heard you say with this one thing you said that it was just young creative people's approach to the music. Can you talk more to that?
Yeah. Okay, so nowadays, I'll go backwards, start with what it is. The average self-described young bluegrass musician either has not heard anything that happened before 1990, or if they did, they can't relate to it because the recording is not high fidelity. They go, what is this live recordings from 1951? They don't want to listen to it. I'm going to go off on a tangent. Don't let me go too far.
I'll reel you in, Jody. I'll reel you in.
I had a student and friend of mine who used to teach at St. Mary's College in Lafayette. It's about an hour and a half from here. I give a talk about various kinds of folk music. And I brought, these are the days of cassettes, so it was really quite a long time ago. Now that I think about it, but I made, you know, all kinds of stuff showing that, you know, links between Ireland and Africa and blues and gospel music and bluegrass and rock and roll and all these things, how, you know, showing these similarities. And I go from one song to another. And after the fifth thing, I could see I simply did not have them. They could not listen to this old stuff. And this was, you know, I was playing the Soul Stirrers. But even that, they couldn't, you know, they couldn't, even Howling Wolf, they couldn't deal with.
One summer day, she went away. She gone and left me. She gone to stay. But now she gone, and I can't worry, because I'm setting on.
I turned off the machine, I got out my fiddle, and I started to play, and I had everyone on the edge of their seats because they thought I was a wizard. Because not one of them had ever heard music that didn't come out of a speaker, even if they went to, you know, electronically. Even if they went to a gig, it was coming through microphones, except for the few who had been to Ireland, and they had heard it, you know, in a pub. Or at their, you know, uncle's house.
Yeah,
or something.
Sure, I understand.
But so you have this mentality in the young bluegrass musicians, but you also have an eagerness and a willingness to compose, to do something new, to take some chances, to combine things that never went before together and see if they can go together. And there's this adventurous spirit. They are lacking, for the most part, rootedness. They're lacking depth, but they're game. Let's go try. Now, the average...
Let me pause you on that. What does "they're lacking depth" mean? They're lacking rootedness mean?
When you hear any first-generation bluegrass musician sing three words or play a G chord on the guitar or play the first two notes of an instrument, you know something's happening. There is a weight to it. There's a substance. And there's a substance to the music. And one reason is because they heard all the old music that had been made by older people.
Yeah.
And a lot of that music is formed by the land where they lived.
Yeah.
I've had some great talks with Peter Rowan about this, about where you are affects what you sound like.
Yeah.
Now, in the old time, scene or whatever you want to call it, the old people who call themselves that, they certainly have heard old music and they've studied well the means to bring it out. By which I mean, you move your fiddle bow like this, you move your right hand like this on the banjo, you make really steady beats on the guitar and you separate the bass note from the chord, and you're adamant about the rhythm, and you sing the words to convey the meaning rather than to convey your skill as a stylist. Now, these things, a lot of them have this, but they're suspicious of making up your own tune. Not only do they not do it, being creative is, huh? What, why would I? And therefore it's boring because it is not alive. It's alive when you're in the act of making the music, and all the people that they admire and copy, they made their own versions of the repertoire. They were all creative artists.
Yeah, Doc Boggs, Clarence Ashley, these were all very creative people.
Extremely, extremely so. And that's why you have, an instrumentalist or singer from a particular area, and 2 miles away, next door, the same repertoire is done in a different way. It even got to the extreme of, okay, let's play, some get together playing music. Someone calls out a tune. Whose version?
Yeah.
Someone will say, but whose version? Our version. The way it goes today.
Yeah.
I mean, this afternoon, the way tomorrow it'll be different.
So I see that division now, and I understand what you're saying there. Why did you leave New York?
I did not. You were saying, you asked me, Jody, did you ever have, the experience on stage? Oh, yeah, this is where I belong. I had the feeling my whole life, I don't belong here in New York.
Why not?
I don't know. It was not the place for me. I did not really feel comfortable there. I mean, I like Brooklyn better than Manhattan, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. I just didn't really fit. Mm. I started hearing about the West Coast. People would come back, and one guy described, he said, man, the molecules are more far apart there. Okay, there's a sense of space. The West Coast was where, many people who live here were born here, but there's also people who came from other places and they couldn't get any further because there's a Pacific Ocean, that's it. And then you kind of ended up there. Right. And there was a spirit in the Bay Area. You could be what you were, who you were, and people left you alone. You could just, be, there's room to breathe.
Was there ever an opportunity for an instrumentalist of your capability at the time to end up like Gene Loewinger or end up like Bill Keith, like playing with Monroe or playing with the Stanleys, like joining a touring bluegrass band? Did that ever come up?
Not for me, it didn't, but I didn't want to do that.
You didn't want to do that?
No. By the time I was old enough to do that, by the time I was 19, say, I did play in the Greenbrier Boys.
Yeah, pretty good.
But that was a New York band.
Yeah.
I was already interested in so many other kinds of music. Mm. And the summer of 1965, I met Joseph Spence from the Bahamas and Joaquin Bautista from Mexico, both guitar players. I was just fascinated with how they played. Mississippi Fred McDowell, played blues guitar with a slide. I was into all these things.
You got to move. You got to move. You got to move, child. You got to move. But one day long.
Right then, I was learning and then wasn't too much after that I got into North Indian raga music. So no, I didn't want to spend all my time playing bluegrass, but there's a bigger reason, and that is, by the time I was in my early 20s, there was only one band that I was aware of, one top bluegrass band that was playing what I thought was bluegrass music. It was the older stuff, and that was Ralph Stanley's band. And there's no way I'd fit in there. I mean, for one thing, I didn't like wearing a suit and a tie.
Yeah, I understand.
And I wasn't a doper. That's not what it was. It was just, you know, a different way.
Yeah.
But, you know, I always liked what he was doing. And I always liked the Stanley Brothers too, but he took it in a more retro direction.
So what year is this? You go to the West Coast?
I would hitchhike out every summer, starting with 64. I finally moved summer of 68. Once I got, I graduated from City College of New York, CCNY, got my degree in English and left.
Well, that would have been, I guess Garcia was doing the jug band thing then?
Yeah. So I met him in 64. We had a band. You know about that?
I only know it from the early. Neil Rosenberg sent me the liner notes for the box set they just did for the early. And you're on that. I'm trying to remember the name of the band right now.
Well, we mostly went by the Asphalt Jungle Mountain Boys. We had lots of gigs. Eric Thompson on guitar, Mia Mandolin, Garcia on banjo.
Jerry Garcia on banjo.
And the thing about Jerry, he was really into singing. You know, and he played a very ornate, what's a kind of Wayman banjo. A Wayman banjo, and you know, and it had all these flowers and vines up and down the neck, and that's how he played. It was this really intricate, whining, crazy idea things, which I just loved.
Yeah.
And we had a really good time singing and playing, and we played at bars, we played at coffee houses, we played every chance we got. It was the summer of 64.
Let me ask this while I got you on this. I've never been able to ask anybody this question before, and I'm no deadhead, but I'm curious about this. Was it weird that your friend who you played banjo with was also playing this sort of like drugged out, merry prankster, psychedelic rock music too, or even around the same time? Was that odd to you at all?
You know, the big change came between the summer of 64 and when I returned in the summer of 65. I think in between there was the Mother McCree Jug Stompers, whatever it was called. Yeah. I never heard that band.
Since cocaine went out of style, you can catch them shooting needles all the while.
Hey, hey, honey. take a whiff on me.
If you don't think coke is mighty good, just have a rose and mingle wood.
Hey, hey, honey, take a whiff on me.
The music before there was a Grateful Dead, at Jerry's house, there would be these jam sessions where they would play whatever occurred to them. That was not weird. I was doing that.
Yeah.
Also, playing without a preconceived form or a destination. But, yeah, the drug part was weird, and it changed him. It made him, you know, he's already an unusual personality, but it made him more remote and harder to relate to. Where I, the 64, there was no difficulty at all.
I can only imagine that, you know, having these friends who you play music with, and then all of a sudden this other scene happens, and, you know, while you're away. Are you, when you come to the West Coast and you start playing music, this is a dangerous question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Go ahead.
Do you have any goals? Some people's goal is to be a star. Some people's goal is to, did you have any goals?
Like I said, the only thing I knew was how to play music.
You just wanted to play for the sheer experience of it.
Yeah. The one thing that younger people now don't understand about what it was like to be alive then is that living was almost free. You didn't need money. Until about the first third of the 1970s, the various places I lived, I needed about between $20 and $35 for rent per month. $10 a week is way more than you need for all the food you could possibly eat. So I didn't really need a whole lot of money. And generally it's still this way with young people everywhere. Nobody could afford to rent a house or an apartment. So you get a whole bunch of people together and you rent a room. And so I had lots of free time. I didn't have a job, you know, a salary job or particular hours.
You didn't have any deep ambition to go become a country star or to play with country stars or move to Nashville, or that's at least interesting to me. You know,
I did appreciated a recognition for my musical point of view. And when I made my first LP, which was done at the invitation of a guy who had just started a record company, Mike Cogan, I happened to attend a birthday party, or he was attending a birthday party in the backyard of my girlfriend. Somebody was 2 years old or something, and there he was, and I'm making a new Bay record. You should make a record for me. Okay. And so I wanted to make a point with that record because everyone was using, they're trying to make their records sound more like records and rather than like people making music. And so it's a very dry recording that has very little echo or none.
This is going up on the mountain.
No, this is Snake Baked a Hoe Cake before going up on the mountain. Jody Stecker and Friends. It's me playing some solo, and also with Fred Sokolow on banjo, Jack Calianzis and Marty Somberg on fiddle.
So let's keep on this. People were making records that sounded like records. What did you want your record to sound like?
Sound like music.
What's the difference?
More like a field recording. In other words, to make it sound like people making music. And one friend of mine teased me. He said, "You've just made a Folkways record. You know, it just sounds like people." I said, "That's what I wanted to do."
Why? Is that more spiritually nourishing for you? Is that, I know that might be a hard question. Why?
The same reason that I wanted to play music. I just did. Now, the next record I made, Go Up on the Mountain, was a whole other deal. That it had no, I feel like that wish that I had was holding me back. And I thought that was, it was a ideological thing that had nothing to do with music that was putting me in a smaller box than I wanted to be in. Going up on the mountain was just a pure release of energy. And it was me and some friends and some compatible musicians pouring out our hearts. And that's what it was. And so to me, I wanted to make a pure record. The second one was a pure record because I had no philosophy and no ideas. I wanted to sound like this. Let's do it. Okay. Who do I want to do? Well, let's get Larry Hanks to sing bass. Oh boy, this will be great, you know. I wonder if John Harrell, my old bandmate, would come out and do it. You know,
the great John Harrell, yeah.
From the singing guitar, playing guitar all over that record.
Do you know how meaningful that record is to a lot of people, especially a lot of younger people? Are you aware of that?
I sort of got the idea from Stephanie, but no, I know that you can't get it, can't find it anywhere.
It's on Spotify. I can tell you that much.
I mean, you know, acoustic disc. Well, everyone there was a big fan of that record.
Yeah.
And they put it out as a CD plus half of Snake Baked Ahokay. It's completely straightforward. So there wasn't room for two LPs on one CD. So David said, okay, I want all the vocals to be on from Snake Baked Ahokay to be on this new release. So we got all that. We got to kick out some instrumentals. Okay. I hate this one. Okay, you're done. I said, okay, you know, I'm sorry we released this one. Let's get rid of that one. Okay, I'm going to kick off that one. Oh, really? Okay, well, I'll kick off that one. That's how we did it.
It has become a very meaningful record for a lot of young folk musicians. And it's also become one of those records that I can, particularly the Hills of Idaho, like, I can send people that piece of music to the one with everybody on it.
Yeah, which we close the, I close the album with. Right? Yeah.
Where the bays run together, bide away my days in the hills of Idaho. I'll haul out my sails where the bays run together, bide away.
Whenever I send that to people, that's usually a way for me to get people. It's sort of like you ever hear that bacon is a gateway meat and that like weed is a gateway drug? Sometimes I feel like that song can be a gateway into the music that I care about, you know, for people who, you know, for music that's meaningful to me. It's a beautiful record, Joe.
Thank you. I'll tell you how that arrangement came about.
Please.
So you'll notice, you know, this is supposed, you know, there's an electric lap steel on there. That didn't matter to me. I wasn't, you know, like, does it sound good? Does it work? You know, Bill Monroe recorded with electric guitar and accordion. There's also an electric lap steel on one song on Snake Baked Ahokay. I was living in Washington State, and Larry Hanks came to visit, and we were singing Idaho, which I had recently learned, and he sang this phenomenal bass part.
Where did you learn it?
Expo 74 from a boat builder named David Jackson, who learned it from Gordon Bach, who was a boat builder who composed it. So it's an interesting song. What it says, most people don't understand it. The key word is but. Each verse is about a different place that's better than Idaho. It's just this rock, you know, and got nothing to recommend it, but there's... You're a damn fool if you stay, but there's no better place to go. I'm from here. So, you know, Iloho, the high island, you know, yeah. Anyway, it's So the chorus begins, but I'll hold down my sails. Anyway, he sang this amazing part. Meanwhile, also at Expo 74, I had met Kate, and she had sung it with me, and it was a completely different thing. She's not on that last track, but we did do it as a duet. The first duet ever, first Jody and Kate duet ever.
This is before you were together. This is before you were an item, as they say.
We circled each other for years. We always had some other mate or lived in different, different cities, different places. So Larry had to be on it. Then when the band came together, like, oh, John Harold can let's see what kind of tenor part he comes up with. Fred had been singing, but Fred, why don't you play the steel? You know, okay, good. Okay, he was a dobro player as well as a banjo player, but I thought the sound of a steel. And does that one have harmonium on it? I think it does. Yeah, so that's George Ruckert. Anyway, so he's on there too. So, you know, and we're all in a great mood, and Kate. And so. Anyway, so I'm glad that record is meaningful for people. It's Kate's favorite record ever, still. And she still tells me that. I say, gosh, I would hope I would have done better by now. She said, well, those are good too.
My friends and I, and a lot of us, are affected by Going Up on the Mountain the way I would be affected by the Krishna Bhatt record, the way I would be affected in particular by the Utah Phillips record that you and Kate made, and by a lot of your music, Jody, is that there seems to be, between North Indian music, Cape Breton music, Scottish music, Irish music, on a little bit of Irish music on this new record, bluegrass music, old time music, there seems to be a core of something in all of them for you.
Yeah.
Can you talk to that?
Yeah. When I studied how to make raga music, the way it's formulated, the way the theory is in North India, it's a little different in the South. I've been affected by South Indian music too, is really rather new. It's 20th century, a lot of it came in the 20th century, to describe something that, of course, was slowly changing, as all traditional musics do, but was sort of the same thing. But and the same thing has happened in Arabic music too, where words and ideas are put in to describe something that people already did. They weren't following these rules, but they discovered that there were actually patterns to what people were doing. And you could describe it in terms of pattern, and, well, it ascends this way and it descends that way. And, you know, in this particular raga, this particular note has way more weight than the other, and you hardly touch it on this other one. And all the songs that are in this raga go like this. So then people started learning it that way. Oh, well, I have to leave this out. I have to put the emphasis on this. And the results are very much the same. It's okay. Once I had that particular grid to look at music, I realized that all the old traditional music that I'd loved and listened to and played did the same thing, only they weren't following rules. And actually the practitioners, they kind of knew about it, but they wouldn't put it in words. But it actually was the same thing, that there are hidden structures and patterns, and those notes, those pitches that are between the frets that all the singers do, are the real notes. The frets are approximations, and that's why fiddlers intone the way that they do, because it's just what the singers do. They don't have the impediment of the frets, which are in between the real notes. You can't get this note on a fret.
Yep.
It's between. Not only that, it moves. It ascends. It's a little higher than D. So that's one thing. Now there's another thing. When I first started studying with Z.M. Dogger, my main raga teacher, I compared notes, memories of this, with his son, who's now 50, but I met when he was 9. In the first lessons that I had with him, I felt like there was a old-time movie projector running, you know, that played reels and went tick, 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 tick. There's this, even this sound of crickets. This, and something was coming from through him to me, and he was implanting the music. And those seeds found fertile ground in me because that ground was prepared, because something like it I already had. Completely different answer. There's a sound. There's a certain sound that I get on all my instruments and in my voice. And you'll know it's me. It's the same thing. But I say, well, I like the first generation bluegrass musicians. You know it's them right away. Now, they may have been motivated probably mostly by survival. That's, you know, the motivation matters less. That is, your band had to sound different than somebody else. They wanted that, they'd have to hire you. So Mac Wiseman, you don't think that's Bobby Osborne. And, you know, everybody's got their distinctive sound. Now you don't know who it is.
How do you balance the technical dexterity required to be able to pick up an instrument and play it at a competent level with the intuitiveness needed to achieve what you're going for there?
It's hours spent. You know, when I, with my students, I emphasize technique.
Really?
Not because I want them to become a technician. I want them to become reliable so that their hands are reliable, so they don't have to pay any attention to how they're doing what they're doing, but rather what it feels like. So you have, if you're an able craftsman, you don't have to worry about how am I going to do this.
How much is a meditation practice useful in playing music, in not thinking not just about the notes you're playing, but about who's listening, what the person you're accompanying might want?
There's a lot of things that are called meditation that look the same from the outside. Somebody sitting still and their eyes are closed. Or not even. It'd be open. Meditation involves being present.
Yeah.
And generally, you know, at one stage or another, you're aware of your breath and you're bringing it back, and inevitably you'll be thinking. When you discover you're thinking, bring it back. Okay. Well, it's the same with playing music. It's being present. You know, you're there. And that, when you're present, you're less likely to go out of tune, because, you know, you're not thinking ahead. How does that next phrase begin? How, you know, what's the words, or where am I going to put my fingers? When that happens, it's often that the last note of a phrase is botched because the musician isn't there.
You've had a practice for a while, right?
Yeah. There isn't a fine line between when I'm meditating and when I'm not. It's just the same thing as when I'm making music and when I'm not, or when I'm, you know, people asking me how to practice their instrument. You know, it's like, number one, whatever that instrument is, you know, you've got to keep it out of the case. It's got to be there, because opening those latches is enough of an impediment to say, I'll do it tomorrow. But that's the number one thing. And then you need to practice, you know, in the beginning, you need to be at it at least 15, 20 or half an hour, minutes, until you get into what I call the zone. You know, where the music starts happening and there's a flow, there's something happening, and you get deeper into the music. But after a while, you're always in the zone, always. You don't have to, you know, just, you pick up the instrument and you're there all the time. So it's kind of like that with meditation practice. Mind you, I mean, I'm doing it 10 hours a day for a week, it's going to be, I haven't done that in a very long time. It's going to be a whole lot different than it is.
It was a big
now.
Change for me when I started my practice as someone who plays pub sessions and backs up fiddle players. I found myself, I mean, I don't really know if I have words for it, but I guess in the past that I would find myself going, does the fiddle player want this? Or I would think, have I done enough interesting things for the people around me to know that I'm good at the guitar? Or have I brought myself out into this music enough? And then when I started my practice, all those things went away. But more importantly, I really enjoyed everything I was playing. Everything, and the session sounded better, and the music just felt better.
Yeah, all that other stuff is the same as the you know, the thought noise that happens when you're meditating. It doesn't matter what the content is. It's completely irrelevant what it is. It's all blah, 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 blah. But, you know, whether it's happy thoughts or, you know, or am I doing this well enough? Aren't they good? Doesn't it? Hey, did you hear that? Or that was bad. It doesn't matter. It's just static.
Yeah. I mean, just back to bluegrass, that's something I think a lot about is what happens when we start talking about virtuosos? What happens when we start talking about people who are exceptionally gifted instrumentally? What happens when people are praised for being the best? And what happens when, because with someone like you, one of the things that I love the most about your music is, and I would say someone like a Larry Sparks, who I talked to yesterday, there'd be a deep heart and soul and fullness of themselves in these notes, prioritized over playing as many triplets as you can. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are the musicians I like to listen to, who play and sing like that. If they can keep the heart and soul and also be pyrotechnical, wow. I mean, it doesn't happen very often, you know, but it can happen.
Before we go, can you tell everybody about, I read this listening exercise you did one time where you encouraged people to, when they listen to a piece of music, to listen to it over and over and over again, and each time to focus on a different instrument playing. Would you have a recollection of telling somebody that?
Anything that I would tell to somebody would be something I would tell to that person, because that's what it seemed to me they needed to hear right then. It wouldn't be a formula for everybody to do.
It was very useful for me. I found. Can you talk about your own experiences doing that?
Well, I have many ways of listening. The most enjoyable way is, you know, the completely innocent, ignorant way, like you're 4 years old and it's just the music washes over you and you don't know what anything is. You don't know the name of the instrument, you know, or what's going on. You just somehow are enchanted by it, or as the case may be, repelled by it. I mean, you know, but something you're enjoying. But then, you know, what I find, you know, especially in bluegrass music with my students, I find with vocal music, the melody is not what they think it is. They always dumb it down. And a lot of really, you know, very, very more than competent instrumentalists, when they take a solo, they're basing it on a dumbed down version of the actual vocal melody. So I do tell my students, you know, listen to Carter Stanley, listen to Jimmy Martin. What are they actually singing? I asked them to pick somebody, you know, whoever it is, those two names that came up. What are they actually singing? Well, how will I know what used to sing along with it? That melody is much more intricate than I realized.
Yeah, Carter Stanley's not singing, I wandered again to my home on the mountains. He's singing, exactly. I wandered again
exactly
to my home on the mountains. Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
Right. And even the shape of the melody is a little different.
Yeah.
than you might think. So you start with that, and then you'll be able to discern it. Because one problem that some people have, especially with sibling duets or even trios that include siblings, it's hard to separate what's the melody there. What, especially because the baritone almost always at one point crosses the melody up higher. And so I said, well, you can get a clue what the melody is by listening to the verse. It might be the same or, you know, or similar to that. Parenthetically, those Bill Monroe CDs that came out recently of all the outtakes from that hotel session. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Wow. Now I know what the actual melody is of When the Golden Leaves Begin to Fall, for instance.
When the moon shines on.
They picked the right take to put out. You can't tell. It's, you know, but then, oh, this is the harmony. Oh, because they're mismixed at first. I just love listening to that stuff. You know, like, and I always was under the impression that everything that the first generation bluegrass records were done was, if it wasn't in the first take, it was in the second. No, he had 5-6 takes. And it wasn't because the musicians weren't satisfied. It's because the engineer blew it.
Yeah.
Didn't have, you know, you got to get the mix then.
Yeah.
Don't mix it later.
Yeah, I know. What keeps you coming back to bluegrass music? You just told me, you just asked me if I listened to this new Bill Monroe outtake session. What keeps you coming back to bluegrass music?
In my blood, just who part of who I am. Can't help it. But, and I wish I liked the newer bluegrass more. I like the people who do it very much. You know, I spent 4 years with Peter Rowan, and you know about that, Peter Rowan Bluegrass Man.
Your version of Catfish Blues on that is one of my favorite recordings.
Yeah, take a stroll out west. I'm going, yes, I'm going, and you'll cry and won't make me stay. Oh, no, you cry now, 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 for you, for you, for you.
Thank you. Okay, so that we would cross paths. We did all the big festivals, and I crossed paths with all these bands, and with a very few exceptions, they're all lovely people. I mean, it's just great. But sometimes some of what they're doing is not my cup of tea, or I go, well, what is that song about? Or most fun with, you know, and the people I'm going to mention now, they're not in that category. I get what they're doing and love it. There was, I've had a couple of times to be on stage at a festival with Ronnie McCurry and Mike Compton, and I'm the third mandolin player. And that is so much fun. One time, it's just me and Ronnie, and we took a break to a song. It was like an assembled, like, you know, 20 bands on stage or something. And we went up, and we immediately knew who was going to play the harmony and who's going to play the melody. We had the phrasing together. We hadn't practiced. This was at the end of a teaching week. We played this thing, and as we backed off, he kind of leaned over to me and he said, you can't teach that at a music camp, at a workshop. The way you know to do that is because you listen to the same stuff. You have the same diet. And therefore, you have the same assumptions. And then there's also, you know, telegraphing. There's or telepathing. There's you kind of know what the other person's going to do.
I think just the quiet, inner, and deep work you've done over your career and your life, I should say, in this music means so much to a generation like mine who has been subjected to the flash and is looking for the substance. And your music has always given that to me. And when we were putting together this new season, it was through that I wanted to be able to spend some time with you and talk to you a little bit about your approach. So I'm very grateful to you, Jody, for making the time.
Thank you. I just, you know, I know there are some, but not many tell me, and so that's good. I hear it. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Sure. You're very welcome.
I rambled on that old Wild Bill Jones. Walking and the talking by my true lover's side, and I bid him to leave her alone.
Yeah, that went everywhere. Early days of New York bluegrass, Bay Area bluegrass, Jerry Garcia, drugs, meditation. I mean, we talked for a lot longer. Maybe someday we'll release like the unedited version, which went on for a really long time. Jody, really like a life-changing musician, I think, when you can access the frequency that he's on and the rhythm that he's on, a lot can really open up for you sort of spiritually and emotionally in the music. And I'm not even wearing sandals when I say that to you right now. I'm just wearing slippers and jeans. All right, so thank you so much for listening. Toy Heart is produced by Stephanie Coleman and me, Tom Power. Our executive producer is Amy Reitnauer Jacobs, with help, as always, from the entire BGS team. Creative director Shelby Williamson, editor Chris Jacobs, who also edits this podcast and does an amazing job of somehow keeping me on schedule, and managing editor Justin Hiltner, all of the writers and contributors
that make BGS the best source for roots culture redefined. Discover more at thebluegrasssituation.com. I've been keeping up on the Bluegrass Situation. They've been doing some really cool stuff around folk music and country music right now. If you haven't gone to the website in a while, pretty cool. Pretty cool writing going on there. Our theme song, Toy Heart by Bill Monroe, was performed by Chris Eldridge and Kristen Andreasen. Chris is out with his band Mighty Poplar right now, who are just an incredible bluegrass band. If this is your first time listening to this show, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Ricky Skaggs, Sam Bush, Larry Sparks, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Just look for Toy Heart. And coming up, you're going to hear my conversation with the legendary Allison Krauss. I'm looking forward to you hearing that. If you like the show, share it with a friend who loves bluegrass music. Stay tuned for so much more coming up this season on Toy Heart. We'll see you soon. Later on.